Hello and welcome to Cooper Talks. Yes, yet another exciting edition of this podcast. This week looking at the Cold War and how it developed between 1949 to 1955. Mostly this is focused on the idea of containment, but it will also link in a little bit with communist Soviet expansion as well. So it overlaps a few areas. Now, 1949 was when the Berlin airlift and Berlin blockade were lifted. And when NATO was created as a means of containing communism where it was in Europe and establishing the clear east-west dividing line, which was all fine and hunky-dory, but there was a whole rest of the world to consider. Now, the biggest other thing that happened in 1949 was that China, which had been undergoing a civil war, during World War II and afterwards, between nationalists led by a guy called Chiang Kai-shek against the Communist Party led by Mao Zedong. Now, the Americans had been backing the nationalist government of Chiang Kai-shek, which was, well, it was democratic in the sense that it wasn't communist. That's probably the best way to put it. And they've been given lots of money and aid to his regime to try and combat a Chinese Communist Party takeover. However, by 1949, Mao's troops, for a number of reasons, had been successful, and mainland China went communist. Now, this is obviously a huge failure of the policy of containment. China, by landmass, is one of the biggest countries in the world. I think it's fourth or fifth biggest. And certainly in terms of population, it was the biggest population. So that's a huge major country turning communist and kind of suggests the failure of the Truman Doctrine and the policy of containment. And it also creates a whole new threat, particularly with the fact that the USSR by 1949 had developed its own atomic weapons and suggested that it would be prepared to share these with China. So there's a huge humiliation going on here. And an increasing lack of distrust in 1949. And that then leads on to the next big issue, which was the Korean War. So Korea, the Korean Peninsula, is over, obviously over in Asia, where Korea is. And it borders China, a little bit of the USSR, and is just across the sea from Japan. Now, during World War II, much like Germany, half of Korea had been liberated from the Japanese by the Americans and was therefore dominated by a capitalist regime, whereas another part, the northern part, had been liberated by communist forces, the USSR and predominantly China, as they were going through their victories. So you ended up with Korea divided in much the same way that Germany was, except instead of east and west, it was north and south, divided along the 38th parallel of latitude. So what does that mean? The northern part had a communist regime set up under the Kim family, who are still in charge. Kim Il-sung was the communist leader and technically is still the head of state in Korea. He was made eternal leader and is technically, officially, still their head of state, if not the head of government. I thought that was interesting to know. Anyway, the southern part was controlled by I'll call it a capitalist regime. Democratic would be a bit of a stretch. It was democratic in the sense that it wasn't communist. But that was good enough for America. So so Truman committed to defending this southern regime under, I'm going to get this horribly wrong, Syngman Rhee, who was the president of South Korea. Now, obviously, both leaders, Kim Il-sung and Rhee, didn't want to give up any of their power, but they also both wanted complete control over the whole Korean Peninsula. So again, we can see problems emerging perhaps here. Slightly different as well, because unlike Germany, obviously Korea hadn't been the main enemy. You know, Japan had been the enemy force that the Americans and communists had defeated. So slightly different from Germany in that sense. But there's increasing tension coming on. And how Truman deals with this in 1950 and the conflict that emerges, says a lot about containment and sets up the battles for the future. So, 1950, the North Koreans, September 1950, I should say, the North Koreans launch a surprise attack and go rampaging right through Korea very quickly. They take over, they capture Seoul and go all the way down so that the capitalist forces and the American allies are trapped in a small southeastern corner of Korea around Busan. So here is a clear expansion of communism defying the Truman Doctrine. So Truman's got a choice here. He can either act unilaterally and send American troops in to go it alone, or he can maybe try and use the United Nations and get combined support for the for a conquest of Korea, or liberation of Korea, I should say. Or he could just ignore it and do nothing. Now, most American people didn't really care about the Korean War. We're still in the shadow of World War II. And they really didn't see the point or the reason for committing lots of troops there. And unilateral action by America on its own may well have triggered a wider conflict. It may have been that the Soviet Union would have come to the rescue of its communist allies, and China equally may have come to its rescue. And also, although America did have the nuclear bomb, and although it did have lots of troops based in the Pacific around Japan, it wasn't clear that it was ready yet to take on such a big war. And the other issue was the UN. The UN had been set up as a counter, well, as a sort of new and improved version of the League of Nations. Unlike the League of Nations, everyone would be a member, or recognised member. It would have its own military, and it would be able to take much more concrete action. And 1950 was the first opportunity, really, to test out the UN and see how it would work. The problem was that in order to ensure everyone was cooperating, the UN had been set up with a Security Council with five permanent members after World War II. So these were the victorious powers, America, the USSR, Britain, France, and who was the other one? Britain, France, USA. Oh, China. Sorry, completely forgot that there. Now, at this stage, there was a bit of an issue because although the communists had taken control over China, they weren't yet recognised at the UN. So technically and officially, the Chinese government that was sat in the UN was that of Chiang Kai-shek, which had gone into exile in Taiwan. And that's still Taiwan unofficially claims to be China today. So that was all right for the USA, but all five permanent members had a veto of any action. So if the USA went through the United Nations, there was a danger that the Soviet Union would just veto a UN action, and then America would look weak and it wouldn't be able to do anything. The third option, doing nothing, may well have pleased American people, but it would have made Truman look weak, and it would have basically shown that the Truman Doctrine was meaningless. So he was being tested here as well, and what he would do. Now, as luck would have it for Truman, because the UN was failing to recognise communist China as the official Chinese representative at the UN, Stalin was boycotting the UN at the moment the Korean War broke out. So Truman had an opportunity, and he proposed that the United Nations as a whole would intervene in Korea. Because the USSR wasn't there, and because communist China wasn't recognised, no one vetoed it, and he was able to get the decision passed by the Security Council. So that was a huge victory for Truman, and it meant that the UN, not just America, but the UN, a task force of different nations, including Britain, Australia, and many others, would intervene to liberate South Korea from North Korean control. As a side note, Stalin and the Soviet Union never made the mistake of boycotting the UN again. So in October 1950, a United Nations task force, which was led by the Americans, landed in Busan, and they very quickly were able to drive back the North Korean army. Actually, they were so successful, they went beyond the 38th parallel and drove them all the way back to, well, nearly to the Chinese border. Now, this was a bit of an issue because obviously it's going beyond the original mandate of simply containing communism and therefore liberating South Korea from North Korean control. They'd done that when they reached the 38th parallel, but by pressing on, they'd gone much further than intended. And it looked like they were trying to destroy communism. Now, China's leader, Mao Zedong, had said that if they carry on into the north, the Chinese would commit forces. Now, South Korea, small country, small population, relatively poor, relatively weak military in 1950. That was one thing. But taking on the Chinese, particularly the Chinese Communist government, which had just won a major civil war, that was a much bigger and much harder prospect. So, although they pressed on towards the Chinese border, the nature of the war was changing. Now, Truman, it appears, got a bit carried away here and almost broke his own doctrine by trying to liberate the whole of the Korean Peninsula. However, and he was working with sort of General Douglas MacArthur. Now, MacArthur was an American hero. He'd been in charge predominantly of the Pacific troops during the World War II. He was the guy who was seen as being responsible for liberating Japan. So he's a huge icon. Now, they initially seemed to be prepared to take on China. I remember, China's only just become communist. And are willing, despite Mao's warnings, to take this on. Now, when the Chinese start sort of defending and firing, MacArthur wants to take on the Chinese. Truman realizes this would be a bit of a mistake, particularly when 200,000 Chinese troops volunteer, they call themselves People's Volunteers, to come and help the North Koreans. And they launch a counterattack against Truman's American forces or the United Nations forces and push them right back to the 38th parallel. Now, this was humiliating for the Americans. The Chinese were much better organized than the Koreans had been and pushed them back to the 38th parallel. So while MacArthur was ready to commit to a huge long war to fight back and push the Chinese and the Koreans back to the Yalu River border and defeat communism in China, Truman realized that this would be a huge mistake. The American public wouldn't go for it, and the UN probably wouldn't go for it. However, initially, MacArthur ignored Truman and tried to continue the war, ignoring the UN instructions, and started openly threatening to attack and invade China directly, so escalating the war in American interests far beyond the original intentions. So at this point, Truman has to make a decision on what to do, and he decides to remove MacArthur. This creates a powerful enemy. MacArthur will quite happily talk about how weak Truman is and criticize Truman, but it probably was the right decision because at this stage, there was no will and no real desire to fight in China. And as we know from later on in the course, the Americans got bogged down fighting Vietnam as a foreign war overseas, logistically very tough. It would have been an absolute disaster against China. So although history would judge sacking MacArthur as the right decision, it did have a detrimental effect on Truman's reputation. Now, in 1951, peace talks began, centered around an armistice around the 38th parallel, so exactly where it had all begun. Although technically fighting would still go on for a couple of more years while these talks were going on. By 1953, the formal armistice was signed, and in a kind of snub to Truman, this was only done after Truman had left office when he'd been replaced by President Eisenhower. And that was deliberate. They kind of held on so Truman wouldn't get any credit for ending the conflict. Now, it was only an armistice. Much like with Germany and its division between East and West, technically the war was still going on. So technically World War II was still going on because there was no Germany to sign a peace treaty. Well, even today, there is no formal peace treaty between North and South Korea. They are technically still at war, and that is why the 38th parallel today is still a huge and militarized border between the two, and those tensions exist. So, the Korean War, what happened there? Well, was it a success? In a sense, yes, because by the end of it, South Korea and North Korea were where they had been before. So in that sense, communism had tried to expand into South Korea, and it had been defeated and therefore contained. So in that sense, Truman Doctrine's been successful. Equally, it's worth considering that over the long run, South Korea would develop as a democracy and would become a true democracy and become a really vibrant and high-powered economy that would justify America's faith in it. So in that sense, as an ally, it was a great victory for America as well. And it's worth bearing in mind that this also showed that the UN would use military force and would be a much more effective organization than the League of Nations had been. And a lot of commentators like David Lowe, the cartoonist, who'd been very critical of the League of Nations' weaknesses, were very complimentary about the strength of the UN and saw it as a much more effective organization. So again, a success in that sense. However, the failures kind of revolve around the fact that Truman had shown that actually he was quite flexible with his doctrine, that he was prepared to attack and eliminate communism in weaker states, North Korea being a weakened state. And again, that meant his attitude that he'd allow communism to survive where it already existed was seen as a bit of a hollow sham. And that's going to encourage China and the Soviet Union to give support to fledgling communist regimes. And that's going to have an impact later in places like Vietnam and Cuba and Cambodia. So it makes the situation a lot worse. And also, although they probably would have been enemies anyway, it brought in a lot of hostility between America and the new Communist Party of China, and creates an enemy there. And also, again, probably naturally would have happened anyway, but gives a stronger alliance between Mao and Stalin in these early days. So that's the Korean War. It was a success, but a mixed bag. And again, the Americans had, and the United Nations forces, they suffered huge casualties, and it was a really difficult and challenging war. And it showed the problems they had in fighting in theatres of war that were outside the sort of North American or European, relatively flat grassland, hills, plains, you know, very different conditions in Korea, showed the weaknesses that they'd have there. So that's the Korean War, which goes up to 1953. But some other issues that happen in this time period that are worth considering is the big development was the arms race. So obviously America had had the nuclear bomb since 1945. By 1949, China's developed it. And the drive then is to promote what's called, they call it the hydrogen bomb. And this is about nuclear fusion. So nuclear fission, which is where you divide an atom, was very powerful. That's what the original nuclear bombs were about. But nuclear fusion, where you force atoms together, releases a lot more energy. That's how stars burn. That's what powers the sun. It's the fusion of hydrogen atoms. So much more powerful. In the early 1950s, both sides were, in quite short succession, able to develop these hydrogen bombs. And then they started developing more and more powerful weapons and methods of delivery. So until the 1950s, the common method of delivery was by plane. So you actually had to fly a plane over. That means it can be shot down. But they both start trying to invest in missile technology, which would deliver it at much less risk to the pilots or to the armed services, and make it a more threatening weapon. So both sides now are developing nuclear missiles, and the Soviet Union is investing in this military build-up to try and equalize relationships with America. Now, at the same time, other countries start developing their own nuclear bombs. Britain probably would have been second, but due to a spying scandal, the Soviet Union beat them because they've been spying on them. The British actually, they sort of developed their own nuclear weapons, but they're still a long way behind America. So America made a deal whereby Britain would stop its independent program and then lease or rent, effectively, nuclear weapons from America. And France would follow soon after in the 1950s. To balance that out, the Soviet Union would share nuclear technology with China. So we see the spread of nuclear weapons, as well as the development of more powerful weapons and more powerful delivery methods. And this will, by the end of the 1950s, lead to a concept called MAD, mutually assured destruction. The idea being that nuclear weapons, it would be so crazy to use them that it would act as a form of deterrent. The idea being that, let's say, it takes 15 minutes to fire an intercontinental ballistic missile to be launched from one country to reach the other country. Well, there's not a lot you can do about that, but in that 15 minutes, you could then launch your own missiles. And therefore, both countries would be assured of destruction, so mutually assured destruction. The idea of this was it would act as a kind of check or a balancing act, that neither side would risk a nuclear attack for fear of itself being destroyed. That's obviously fine for the big two. Other countries were less keen. Britain, France and European countries said, well, hang on, we're a bit closer to Russia, so we could be in the line of sight. So it did cause tensions within alliances. And it played on fear. And throughout the rest of the 1950s, there was a huge fear, both countries, of a nuclear holocaust. In order to combat that, they wanted to give themselves increasing advantages over their rivals. So we get this arms race where we just get each side developing more and more powerful weapons as they try to gain an advantage over the others. It leads to huge costs, which America could just about cope, but in the long run would be detrimental to the Soviet Union. Now, on top of that, we also get the formation of other alliances. So I mentioned NATO before, but we also get SETO, the Southeast Asian Treaty Organization, and something called CENTO, which was based in Central Asia, effectively. And through all of this, the Americans are giving aid and alliance to these countries to try and, if you like, encircle the communist states of the USSR and China and Eastern Europe. This, in turn, causes resentment. The Soviet Union, as a reaction to all of this, by 1955, will set up the Warsaw Treaty Organization, which will become known as the Warsaw Pact. That was basically in Eastern Europe, apart from Yugoslavia, but again, a mutual protection agreement between them. So we get the world forming into these two major blocks with the potential threat of a huge nuclear Armageddon coming and destroying everyone. Two other things worth considering from this period. One is that the McCarthy trials kicked off in America. Now, Joseph McCarthy was this alcoholic conservative Republican who just started claiming that lots and lots of people throughout America in high powers, in government and in the media, were communists. And you ended up with these sort of witch trials going on where he claimed to have evidence, which wasn't really true, but these people lost their careers, jobs, were banned from certain things. Now, this led to an anti-communist hysteria sweeping America, which is pretty damaging anyway, but it also shows the hatred that Americans have to communist and communist forces, and that further alienates communist regimes from working with America. And it makes it almost impossible for any American president or leader to be able to, you know, meet or compromise with the communists for fear of being accused of being sympathetic to communism or an enemy of America. And the last thing for this time period that's worth noting is that in 1953, Joseph Stalin died. So Stalin had been this major dictator, absolutely dominated the Soviet Union, was held together by his force of will and a brutal regime. I will at some point be doing podcasts on Russia where I'll cover Stalin in more detail. I think it's testament to how feared Stalin was that one of the reasons he died when he did was he'd given orders not to be disturbed when he went to bed. And he then had a massive stroke, but it took hours, I think most of a day, before anyone dared to look in the room because he'd said not to be disturbed. And as a result, the stroke completely debilitated him and there was no chance of recovery. There may not have been anyway. But his death in 1953 caused some uncertainty in the Soviet Union over who was going to take over. And that's going to lead to some uncertainty, which the Americans could maybe have exploited, but also a great fear over what would happen next. Now, initially, it was a panel of three people that took over the running of the Soviet Union. But towards the end of the 1950s, one man will come through as the ultimate champion, which would be Nikita Khrushchev. And so in the late 1950s, we then get the war moving on to the next stage. And I think as we've got to about 25 minutes here, that will be a useful point to end. So next time, I'm going to pick up with the Hungarian uprising, which happened in 1956. And that's the moment where Khrushchev really started to establish his control. But I hope that's been useful in terms of giving you the broader context of what was going on and how it would all fit together. I hope you're okay. I hope you're coping with any stress in your lives, and that these are in some way alleviating that stress, or at least helping you achieve your goals and you find them interesting. Take care, and I'll speak to you again soon. Bye.